This week on From the Vault, we're looking at the family in America, the roles of men and women in society, marriage, raising children, sex, free love, hetero, homo, and bisexuality, legalizing marijuana, college students, Indonesia, Samoa, cancer, and the list could just go on and on. I know it sounds like we're going to air highlights from Oprah or an episode of Grey's Anatomy, but no. All these topics fit into this one little show because of a woman born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1901, whom the governor of Florida once called a dirty old lady. And, well, this dirty old lady was married three times, once dated a man who tried to reform her of what he called her prostitution complex. She had a lifelong affair with another woman and once responded when asked about her views on free love, quote, "You drink one good wine with one dish and another good wine with another." But to more than one generation of women, she was hailed as a feminist, although she preferred to think of herself as feminine. And a leading expert on mind research once said of her, "She has one of the most filled minds of any person I've ever come into contact with, and uses more of her intellectual capacity than anyone I've ever known." She's also credited with saying 22 words you've most certainly seen on t-shirts, bumper stickers, and banners all around the world. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. This week on From the Vault, we're looking at Margaret Mead.
A young married couple today expect to have the kind of house and car and television set and radio and facilities for education and medicine for their children that in the past people would have thought they had to work and save for 10 or 15 years. There's a tendency to foreshorten life and live it now with an underlying fear that the future is hopelessly uncertain. And you better get your joy now, all of it. Marriage, parenthood, house ownership, and grounds, and power lawnmower at once.
Hi, I'm Christopher Sprinkle, producer of From the Vault, sitting in for Brian DeShazer, From the Vault's regular host and the director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Comments like this one were what made Margaret Mead so special. While discussing a point, she made her audience think, she made them laugh, and she made them question their own behavior. And then she would take that first point, which hits you on a personal level, and she would make it larger and larger in scope.
And we have a very curious foreshortening of life, which is very comparable to what was once found among the very poor. The people who didn't know where tomorrow's meal was coming from. If they got some money, they ate it and drank it up and bought what they could on tick. So they bought something and they had a stove for 3 months, and then they couldn't pay the installments, so they came and took the stove away. They'd had it for 3 months. Now this is the present position all over this country, in every class, that people are buying every single thing they can on time. And they're mortgaging 30 years ahead of their lives, which they don't quite believe will be there, in order to have 4 or 5 years in which everything that they have learned they should have and have a right to as human beings is concentrated, with a general feeling, well, then if a recession comes, then if the atom bomb comes, then if a world war comes, we've had it. We've grown up, we've been married, we've had a home, we've had children, now. And so that a general sense of world insecurity seems to be bringing about in the richest and most prosperous country in the world a type of behavior that was once associated with extreme poverty.
And she ends up speaking about the political and economic ramifications of each one of us living our life in the now. Keep in mind, Margaret Mead was speaking in 1960 to a group of students at Stanford University.
Now, of course, these modern marriages are not being conducted in slums. They're living with the highest standard of living the world has ever known, and with an appalling concentration of natural resources, some of them irreplaceable. North America, with 7% of the population of the world is using up 50% of the irreplaceable resources of this earth every year. In order to treat each house as if it were the private a preserve of a Roman emperor.
By this point, as an audience member, you not only see your own behavior, but you recognize how your behavior plays a part in this huge inequity that exists in the world. Now, of course, I can't speak for her, but I get the impression she understands certain things, like Catholic guilt. If you were in her audience and left the auditorium with a bit of guilt, well, maybe you begin to make a few changes in your life. Or maybe not. Who knows? Margaret Mead never considered herself an activist who meant to change the world. She was an anthropologist whose main objective is to observe society and note similarities and differences and both question and try to answer why those similarities and differences are there and how they formed. And what I found out in putting together this program is that it is impossible to be able to adequately explain Margaret Mead's entire life in 1.5 hour. The Pacifica Radio Archives has nearly 30 hours worth of audio recordings of Miss Mead, but she almost never talks about her own experience. And so the simple facts, like her birth in 1901, her 3 marriages to first her high school sweetheart, Luther Cressman, and then to fellow anthropologists Rio Fortune and Gregory Bateson, her lifelong affair with Ruth Benedict, her 28 honorary doctorates, her death from cancer in 1978, and her being awarded posthumously the Presidential Medal of Freedom, these facts are easy to come by, and they help show what an interesting and groundbreaking woman she was. But it was her mind that attracted most everyone to her. Margaret Mead thought about things no one else had yet considered, and she could explain those thoughts with details the masses understood. And so there is no better way for us to share Mead's life with you than to play as much of her speaking as possible.
Another thing that we notice when we look at forms of marriage through history is that every time that we've had any kind of violent religious or political reform, it's usually been accompanied by monkeying with the family. And most prophets seek to work out the ramifications of their power and inspiration by changing the form of the family, changing the sex standards, and advancing some other style of family life. And the more extreme the prophecy, the more radical the change that has to go on in family life. You can make women do almost anything, and you can make men not do almost anything. But it's terribly difficult to make men do things they don't want to in the end. This is a genuine sex difference that can be very important. In the 20s and 30s, men picked their careers first and their girls afterwards. And on the whole, men were exceedingly certain of what they were going to do, whether they were going to be doctors or lawyers or farmers or soldiers or sailors, and had already started on the necessary schooling or steps that would get them their career. They then found a girl who was willing to marry a doctor or a merchant marine sailor. And if the girl didn't want to marry a doctor, she didn't marry that boy, and she refused to go out with him. But the boys made the choice of a career, and the girls acceded to it reluctantly. They fell in love enough, they married men who were doing things they wished they weren't. But they were male choices about their careers, which probably is a fairly good thing. Today, the career choices are being made by the girls to an increasing extent. Boy has a girl he's going steady with, and she's hoping to get married as soon as possible. And he gets caught by a new idea. He studies geology. Geology is one of the most unpopular male occupations with the female sex in the country. And so he tells his girl that he's gotten all excited about geology. He thinks he'll be a geologist. She says, "How long will it take?" And after she's thoroughly explored that subject and whether it's likely to postpone their marriage, she then says, "And will you be away from home much?" There's some kind of fixed belief floating around the country that because geology is an earth science that deals with long time periods, it means that husbands will be home, away from home a lot. And the girls are setting up a very simple set of criteria for husbands. They want to get married as soon as possible. Therefore, they want the boys that, who have the, consented to marry them to follow a career that will make marriage possible as soon as possible. They want them to follow a career that will not take them away from family life. They don't want them to do something that they'll think about in the evening.
We want everybody to be married all the time, not necessarily to the same people. So that we bring young people up today with a whole series of quite peculiarly contradictory sets of ideas. One, you should start dating as rapidly as possible. From nursery school on. In some places there's a pause in the fifth grade. In other places there's a pause at 15. That horrible moment when you can't drive yourself and can't bear to have your mother drive you any longer. But in general, parents, teachers, recreation leaders are all pressuring our children into the earliest possible heterosexual activity. Dates at a period when they're too young, even with the dropped age of puberty, they're too young to be ready for any sort of courtship of any kind, and when in fact they're thrown into a panic very often by the sorts of dating behavior that we're forcing on them. One of the things that is standard for the country is the amount of furniture damage that's done by early teen parties. It runs into the millions, I suppose, now. First they turn out the lights, and then they break the furniture. And this breaking the furniture is a sign of panic. They are too young to be put into this kind of a situation. They're frightened, unprepared for it, so they do what people always do when they're frightened. They panic and they riot. Now, the bulk of American parents feel that their children are insisting on doing things earlier than they want them to do. That the girls want to wear lipstick earlier. Yet this picture of an entire group of parents stretching from coast to coast who are against lipstick while all the children are putting on lipstick doesn't make very good sense. And if one examines it a little more closely, we find, A, there's hardly a mother in the country who, if given the choice between her daughter being popular or not wearing lipstick, wouldn't vote for the lipstick.
She famously spoke of the generation gap, bringing it so into the public consciousness that she joked about the phrase going out of style, as fads will do, and she wouldn't be able to mention it a year later without seeming uncool. At the New School for Social Research in New York City in 1969, Margaret Mead told her audience about the generation gap and said it is possible to witness a generation gap anywhere in the world in any culture.
In New Guinea, where one would expect perhaps one of the greatest contrasts in the world because people have come from the Stone Age into the present within one generation, and you have youngsters in school now who write essays that begin with sentences like, my father was a cannibal, I'm going to be a doctor, which is a pretty swift transition.
And in every place on the planet, families had been experiencing the generation gap for ages, especially in America, where we have always had such a large immigrant population, with parents moving here and not speaking the language, and then their children are born here and speak both their parents' old language and the new language. This information disparity is what Margaret Mead called the generation gap. Yet she argued in New York that in 1969, the extreme differences between her generation and the students' generation was unlike anything ever seen before. The differences in the world from pre-World War II to post-World War II was so drastic that, as she said...
Now, I think that the point that makes the present situation drastically different is the fact that now, if young people of 20 look around the world, and no matter where they stand when they look, whether they're schoolboys in New Guinea or in Australia or in China or in South Africa or in the United States, they can't find anyone anywhere who knows what they know. Now, always before, because the rates of change were so uneven in different parts of the world, and they occurred a little bit more slowly, and participation was very much milder, so that there was there'd be a whole generation that knew about something maybe two or three generations ahead of other people. There were always some people, some older people somewhere, who knew more about what was happening to the young than the young knew themselves. There were people they could turn to. And they weren't their own parents in this country, usually, but teachers, philosophers, sages, ancient skilled people, depending on what kind of society one was talking about. There was someone. Now, the very curious situation today is that when young people look around, and this is true no matter where they live, there is no one who has had their experience anywhere. Now, we used to have a sort of a retort from the elders where a man would say to an older man would say to a young man, remember, I've been young and you've never been old. It was devastating. And there really wasn't anything a young man could do about it. It was absolutely true. The older person had been young. He knew all about it. Or it could be assumed that he did. He certainly knew about being young. It was assumed that he knew about being young in that particular society. And whatever the style of being young had been, he'd been in it. And when I was young... one of the things we used to discriminate was between the mothers who knew what you were up to and the mothers who didn't. And we figured out when we were about 10 that mothers that were very good at guessing what you were up to must have been very bad little girls. But there was everywhere the feeling between the young and the old that there were some older people who knew. And you may have had lots of rebellion against authority and lots of restiveness, but nevertheless, there was this steadying fact that there were some people who knew. Now, today, there is no one who knows. Nowhere on this planet are there any older people who have had the post-war experience of growing up in the post-war world. And everybody on this planet has grown up in the post-war world. The children in my little village in the Admiralty Islands who'd had school for about 8 years, and before that were in the Stone Age, all followed John Glenn's flight by radio and were just as related to it and knew what it meant as children here. The children in Bali, who had just gotten school a few years also up in the villages where I worked, drew beautiful pictures of Sputnik much more accurate accounts of the interior of the first Sputnik than many children could hear. So that the gap between people of different levels of sophistication and education has been wiped out.
Now, my grandfather passed away in April of this year. He was 92. He was a part of Margaret Mead's generation, as she was only 11 years older than he was. I used to ask him what it was like to go in one lifetime from using a horse and wagon to get to the grocer, which he did in Virginia when he was a kid, to seeing men hit golf balls on the moon. He told me when he really sat and thought about it, it was rather mind-boggling. Margaret Mead put it this way.
I mean, we have grown up in a state of serial astonishment at one event after another that has changed the face of the world. And we have been able to absorb these things as they came along serially, whereas this post-war generation has had them all simultaneously. This is one of the reasons I think that this present generation is so hopelessly ahistorical. They are not interested in the immediate past, and they're not interested in what one might call the biologically given past, the time their parents and their grandparents lived. They're fascinated by the old Stone Age. If they can just go back a few hundred thousand years, they'd like that very well, and they go back much further than their elders do, who, if you ask them how long ago, they get into the land of fairy almost immediately. And the kids go way back, and they're perfectly at home with Zanthropus, but not with the Depression. Now, granting that the adults have overdone the Depression appallingly, and they've all grown up with this endless, you'll never understand, because you didn't live through the Depression, which is one of the most discouraging and disfiguring remarks that one can possibly make to a student who is expected to understand about ancient Crete or ancient Egypt or Rome, or turn into a good archaeologist dealing with the basket makers. And yet we continue to say to them over and over again, you will never understand because you didn't go through the Depression, which after all is just a few years away, and you've got living informants by the million. And it's very curious, and it sums up some of the things that are happening here. That is, the elders' belief that they cannot communicate what life once was like, which gets summed up in the Depression. I think it's a statement from the elder generation. We cannot tell you what life was like when we were your age.
And yeah, my grandfather, God bless him, used to say over and over to me when I was a young kid,
you will never understand because you didn't go through the Depression.
But my grandfather would also call me to help him figure out how to turn on his VCR. Margaret Mead also had an interesting way of describing the differences between virtue and vice.
We're still Puritans, and we still tend to disallow sex and only justify it if it leads to parenthood. And this repeats the position that Martin Luther took. It's better to marry than to burn, and it's better to have children, and then this puts one in a more respectable position. And it's virtue and not vice. Remember the definition that Butler gave of the difference. If the pain comes before the pleasure, am I going to say this right? I'm suddenly confused. I've been trying to introduce a new... Now, if the pleasure comes before the pain, it's vice. And if the vice comes before the pleasure, it's virtue. No, the pain comes... Can't get it straight, can I? If the pain comes before the pleasure... I'm going to start over. A hangover means it's vice. And that means, and in all the different forms.
And her thoughts on sex were no less interesting.
So the kind of adolescent freedom, which means a month with one boy and 2 months with another and a third month with two others, and then they don't suit, going on from one piece of inexperienced experimentation to another, throwing one relationship after another aside as unsatisfactory, is an extraordinarily poor preparation. It is not a way of acquiring experience. It's a way of acquiring the practice of disappointment. And we have to face the very curious fact that Americans are violently opposed to much association between the experienced and the inexperienced. We don't really like marriages where there's more than a 5-year difference. When a man of 40 marries a girl of 20, we shake our heads. And of course, if a woman of 40 married a man of 20, we don't bother to shake our heads. We know.
One of the things that becomes very apparent after any time spent listening to Margaret Mead is her thoughts on probably anything at all would be a unique pleasure to listen to, whether or not you agree with her. Part of what contributed to her popularity was her charm, her ease of speaking, and the way she could have fun with an audience. She destroyed the cliched image of the intellectual, the one who is uptight, has disheveled hair, wears a corduroy blazer with elbow patches, and probably leads a very boring life most of the time, hunched over a table in a library doing research somewhere. Margaret Mead traveled the world, interacted with people from the most extremely diverse cultures, was acquainted with other scholars, with politicians, and even celebrities. She even became one herself. Her life was anything but boring, and it takes only a couple of seconds listening to her speak to realize this.
Our whole setup, whether it's premarital experimentation of adolescence or marriage, is the ignorant and inexperienced teaching the ignorant and inexperienced, and a perpetuation of clumsiness. And it is probable that we're going to stick to this, because this doesn't only apply to sex, it also applies to cooking.
And so, that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment of the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials of Margaret Mead that we used, her many speeches from around the country on numerous topics, go online at fromthevaultradio.org or call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That phone number again is 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres. Production coordinator, Edgar Toledo. Outreach by Sean Dellis. Accounting by Mariana Berkovich. And customer service by Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers, Daryl Burris, Joseph Filosca, Alan Carmen, and Shailendria Shakur. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. I'm Christopher Sprinkle. Thank you for listening. Thank you.